Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know that you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com as well as Minorities in Pub on Twitter. And the podcast is found on iTunes, TuneIn, and Google Play. I am very happy to round out this wonderful women of color roster I have for the end of the year with Rosalie Morales Kearns. She is the publisher of Shade Mountain Press, and also your debut novel, Kingdom of Women, is coming out this year, December, yes?
December 1st.
December 1st. It's pretty intense, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you about this. I mean, is it fair to say your book, as well as your press, encapsulates so much of your belief system in terms of feminism, truly intersectional feminism?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Sweet. Awesome.
Thank you.
I really want to first start off because you're doing the writer and the publisher angle, and I've had a couple people on, more than a couple, who do both hats, and it's a lot of work. I'm in production, but I also do editing from a developmental, newly acquisitional format, and it's a lot to handle when you're creating your own work as well as providing guidance to people about their work. In terms of the creation of Shade Mountain, can you talk about how that came to be and what you saw missing in the market?
Well, I'd say there were three motivating factors in my decision to start the press. And you're right, there was, I think the first one is, yes, there was a gap. That was one thing. I'll talk about that more. The second thing was sort of deciding that starting a press was something that I could do, and that was a process also. Then the third factor was realizing that I had arrived at a point where I had some time and energy to do it. So three things had to sort of coalesce for me to make that decision. So the first one was, is there a need for a feminist press or feminist presses that focus on literature by women? And definitely there is. Not that there aren't already feminist presses, but we could definitely use more. And the way I realized it in my own life was that as an author, I was looking for agents and then small presses. For my short story collection, which ended up being published in 2012. That was Virgins and Tricksters, and it was published by a very small press called Aqueous Books, which has since closed its doors. But they accepted the manuscript in 2011, and I started looking for agents in 2009. And pretty quickly, it was clear that no agent wanted a collection of feminist literary short stories by an unknown writer. So I started looking for small presses and querying them and so forth. And so I did a lot of research on small presses that accepted submissions from authors directly rather than needing an agent. And what I kept seeing over and over again were small presses that they build themselves as being very cutting edge and very open to unusual or non-commercial type of literary fiction. So as I'm looking through these small presses and visiting their websites and so forth and learning about them, I would go to their list of new titles or new and forthcoming titles and so forth. And, you know, these are small presses, so maybe there might be eight titles or four titles or 10 titles or whatever. But often it was, let's say, eight titles and one by a woman. 10 titles and one by a woman. Eight titles and none by women.
They're publishing a very small amount of books per year
Already.
and have even more dismal representation of women.
Well, and this was just men and women. You know, from what I could, it was a little harder to see about race and ethnicity, at least, but even from what information I could gather, like photos or author biographies or names, none of which can really tell you completely unless it really spells it out. But again, I'd say the women who were there were mostly white women, and there were so few of them. That made me, I was very conscious of that there were lots of small presses out there that were not really responsive to hearing from women authors. And that kind of got reinforced, that perception I had, that was reinforced by the Vita count, Vita.
The very first Vita count?
Yeah, that came out in 2010, and it was about 2009 statistics. It was kind of interesting to see that because it validated what I was feeling. You know, I was like, oh, good. Someone is counting this, and the stats and the numbers really are as dismal as they seem to me. That was really interesting. I don't know if you remember how defensive the conversations were at first when that Vita count came out.
At first.
And first of all, I don't even think it got much attention very early on, but maybe after the first year or so, it started getting more widespread attention. But you'd have so many people in publishing saying, well, women aren't submitting manuscripts, that kind of thing. Women aren't confident. I don't know. I don't remember. There were just all these defensive things like, you know, we only care about quality. We don't care whether the author is male or female. And we're just looking for good literature.
Blah,
and
blah,
why
blah.
Are you even doing that? Exactly. But what seemed to happen later was Vita just kept going. Like, well, we'll just keep counting and we'll just keep reporting every year. And I think some of those people who had been very defensive at the beginning just got to the point where they were just like, okay, let's publish more women. You know, so that was good. Yeah. That was all to the good. So that was one thing, is perceiving the need. And the second thing was that as I was doing this research for small presses, I also realized that there were a lot of people who were just starting this as one-person operations, or maybe a couple was doing it. I realized how many of them were out there, and it kind of just gave me the encouragement to think, well, okay, these other people can do it. I can do it too. It's not rocket science. Although,
were those like famous last words in a way?
Like, because of, when we talk about what would I advise other presses or other people who want to start a press, it would be like, wow, it's a lot more work than you think. So maybe I should rethink that it's not rocket science sentence. But anyway, it gave me encouragement back when I didn't know how complicated it was. And also I realized I have at least somewhat of a background that is useful in this field. I've been a freelance copy editor for over 20 years. So I have the editing part down pat. I feel very confident about that. I felt confident that I had that kind of editorial judgment and ability. And as a fiction writer and as someone who has an MFA and I've taught creative writing, I felt like I could work with fiction writers in terms of content editing as well as the copy editing and so forth. So I thought, okay, I do have a background in this, at least that part of it. Obviously, there's so much more. And then the third element was that I had reached a point, I'd finished the final revision of the novel that you just mentioned, Kingdom of Women, back in, that would have been 2013. So I've been trying to get a publisher as I finished that, I had worked on it for so many years. Finishing it was such a great relief, and I suddenly felt like I had time and energy to take on something new. And I would not have felt like that while I was still in the midst of wrestling with this novel. It was like, okay, this is a good time. Let me try. Let me think about this. Let me research it and see how feasible it is and so forth. So the timing was right for me personally as an author. Doing the work on the press took the place of all that time I had been pouring into writing my fiction.
So I want to also preface that this episode is Skype. You're in New York, which is considered quote unquote a center of publishing, but you're in the state and not the city. When you created Shade Mountain Press and you were doing your research and all that stuff, were you kind of looking into how bigger New York publishers do things, or primarily just at the indies, or, you know, doing kind of a compare and contrast?
Well, I think I was just thinking about it in terms of a very, very small operation because I knew I didn't have anything like the budget of even a larger small press. Really, my location, you know, people can do this. They can start a press anywhere.
Yeah.
If they're doing a purely indie, independent small press. I really think that what I was looking at, my models were other small presses. The newer ones in particular, I think.
And Shade Mountain does fewer titles. Like, you were doing about two a year at one point, weren't you? And now you're doing one a year, or is it still two a year?
I started with two a year for our first 2 years, and then I realized that was just way too much for me time-wise. since I wasn't being paid for it. I wasn't taking money from our proceeds to pay myself. So that was, obviously I was doing that in my spare time, but it also ate into the time I would have normally used for income generating work, which was not good. So I realized that unless I got, you know, some kind of huge grant or something, or a huge bestseller or something like that, there wouldn't be the kind of money where I could just pay myself for the hours I spend as editor, as publicist, you know, as coordinator with printers and designers and so forth. I can't pay myself that. So I thought, okay, let me just dial it back to one a year. Right now, that's what I'm doing. So 2014 and 2015, we had two titles a year. 2015 was the year that one of those titles was on the NPR's best books of the year list.
I remember, wasn't that Vanessa's book?
That's Vanessa Garcia's book, yeah. White Light. 2016, that was the first year we just did one title, and that was Yi Shun Lai's novel, which you know because she was on.
Yes, she was.
So she was a guest right around the time that the novel came out. That came out in May of last year. Mm-hmm. This year, again, just one book. The release date is actually tomorrow, November 9th. That is a collection of poetry by Mary Hood, who is a microbiologist and a poet and just a really cool feminist. And I love her work. So I was really happy to do that. Mm-hmm. It was a book I had kind of wanted to do for a long, long time. So that was different from the previous books and the forthcoming books, which I got from Calls for Submission.
Oh, okay.
Our next book is a novel. Again, that's going to be in February of 2018, so it's only a few months away. But at that point, what I'm trying to do is just one a year in February, unless the money starts pouring in. And then I have a little more, you know, then I would have the time myself or the money to pay others to do some of this work.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you and Annie Kayama, who I spoke with earlier this year too, Annie does her Kayama Press in Canada, and hers is also a labor of love, and she's not necessarily getting compensated for it, but her primary goal is to pay the people on her team. So she went from using money she had to pay for her press and do it all by herself, to expanding it, but really to expand it to get pay her staff. For you and for others who are creating their presses, like Leland Chuck too, not really making the big bucks. So it really does seem about the mission rather than compensation, which I wonder, do you think that also changes the outlook? Because Annie has said, because it's her press and she's putting in so much money for it, she can only really do things she really, really loves. I mean, taking chances means different things to different people, but if you love something, it doesn't feel like you're taking a chance on it so much.
Well, the other aspect of that, at least in my case, because I do the content editing and when possible, the copy editing myself, is that I have to read the manuscript so many times for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm reading it as a submission when I first decide, do I want this or not? I'm reading it when I'm content editing. That's a pretty light touch at that point. Usually, I mean, the books I get are so well-formed and almost perfect, but they need some conversation about some aspects that might be changed, and then copy editing. But then I also read it to get a sense of how to market it, how to describe it, do justice to it for potential reviewers and for the book jacket copy and for the description in Bowker and Amazon and so forth. So you have to read it with that in mind in a whole different process than when you're reading it to edit it. If I don't love the book, that would drive me crazy if I had to read it that many times. Because then, even though I hire a professional proofreader, I still proofread it myself because I have to check how the layout went. Does the layout work? The book done when I get it converted to electronic form as an ebook, I proofread it then. It's just reading it a lot of times. You have to love it for that reason if you have no staff to do those other steps.
So that pressure of being the sole person when you're doing an indie publisher, it feels very intense to me. Just doing it from my end, and I have another editor to give it to. I'm just doing all the editing myself because that was what was decided, not by me. I don't know if it's kind of dizzying in a way to kind of see it different times, keep reading it each time, and then trying to find fixes or not trying to touch it at a certain stage.
Yes. You also have to just let go and realize, okay, you know, this works, and this is the author's vision, and this is what she was trying to do.
Well, let's get to your book, your novel, Kingdom of Women. I went in there, I didn't really read the copy. I wanted to kind of go in blind for this
book. I do that too.
Yeah. For some books, I like just kind of go in blind and I'm taking in the cover and all that stuff that's happening. So I was like, oh, that took a turn. Especially from the first chapter, it's like, oh. So it's not predictable. It's not predictable at all, which I like about books. But there's also, it's interesting because I hesitate to call them heroines because of the complexity of characters and also the perspectives. It's Kingdom of Women, but they're not just women. They're women and men. And there's a level of brutality in reaction to brutality. So in some ways, it's that eye for an eye.
Yes.
Kind of, you know, that quote we always hear. You're more well-versed in religion than I am. And it's interesting because it's the brutality through religion and used, because religion has been used so much as an excuse. And also this opposition of change. The patriarchy, history in general. And there's so, it's so complicated and woven so well. I have to ask, how did this all come together? That's kind of a long way around, but I'm like, how? Like, well, what did you want to explore in this novel? Because it seems like there's a lot here, and it's so, and I don't know if maybe even your publisher thought this, it's so applicable. Like, as of November 8th, 9th, last year, I don't know if that's when it sold or if it sold soon after that.
Well, actually, I think I had submitted to Jaded Ibis in the summer of 2016, and the publisher hadn't had a chance to read it, or she read it in the fall. I know that. And so she contacted me not long before the election. It just wasn't an acceptance yet, but she wanted to feel me out to see, was I amenable to cutting the manuscript because it was way too long? And I said, well, yes, I think I can do that. Here's what I am thinking of doing. So I gave her a description of how I might do that, what I would cut. I got the actual acceptance, like, yes, that'll work. Let's do this. Maybe 2 days after the election. So
wow.
My joy was very muted because I was in such shock that all I could think of was, oh, wow, I wish I had heard this, you know, maybe the day before the election.
Couldn't you have called me on November 6th?
Then I could have just felt unmitigated joy, you know, undiluted joy. After that, yeah. I mean, how funny if this were under a Hillary Clinton presidency, it would seem more far-fetched, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you said you were working on this for several years. It wasn't as though you wrote it in 2016. Yeah.
No, I mean, I finished revising it in 2013, and I probably started it maybe in the year 2000 or something. I mean, I worked on it off and on, especially because I completely stopped for years at a time when I got my MFA, and when I was working on my short story collection, it just got put aside completely for years at a time. In terms of what led to this book, I think there were two major, I mean, there were a lot of seeds, as you called it, or roots or sparks that were responsible for me somehow coming up with this book. And I think two of the main ones were the Catholic Church's attitude toward women, and the second one was male violence against women, and my feelings about that, my thoughts about that, and so forth, as I went through life as a feminist. Just to take the Catholic part first, I went through Catholic kindergarten, Catholic grade school, Catholic high school, and Catholic college for university.
What? Really?
And I got a bachelor's degree in theology. I had a lot of, and my parents dragged us to Mass every Sunday. I was sort of steeped in Catholicism, but in kind of an oppositional way, let's put it that way. So I wasn't the ideal audience, let's say. But, you know, my parents tried. They were very, very well-intentioned and well-meaning and sincere and so forth. And it just didn't take with me. So I just, you know, as an adult, looking back at my mindset as a child, I realized that I just, not only did I lack a sense of reverence for anything, but I also was basically an atheist. And I don't know how usual that is for a child. I realized that I was. It was a little strange because I kind of realized there's no God, but I'm probably going to hell because I think that. So I was kind of accepting some of them, you know, filter out or rationalize everything. It was kind of an interesting combination. My child perceptions of the church was that men were just much more important in that world. Mm. And it wasn't just that only men could be priests, but that priests were given such reverence and had such influence and were seen as so important, and that women were just not up to that measure. Every authority figure was male. God was male, Jesus was male, and the priests were male. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If the priest is the representative of God and that can only be a man, what does that say about women? So mm-hmm. We were, you know, we're indisputably second-class citizens. And of course, that's still the case. The Catholic Church does not allow women to be ordained priests, and I think that's grotesque. I was enraged about that even as a child. It just seemed so unfair. As I got older, ironically, I'm fascinated by religion. So I did a lot of reading on my own and then majored in theology in college and then kept reading on my own. I should have had a list of quotes here that I could tell you, but they were sort of along the lines of you could find so many quotes from people to the effect of, you know, women are evil. Women are the root of evil. Women are the gateway of how evil came into the world. Some of them argued whether women even had souls. They weren't sure about that. I think most Catholics wouldn't necessarily know about that because why would they be reading medieval theology?
Yeah.
Or medieval church history? So it's there, and obviously it has affected the institution.
Mm-hmm.
What if a woman was ordained a priest? What would that be like for her? Because she can't erase the history of that church. Mm-mm. Yet what would that mean for her to embrace the aspects of it that are meaningful and beautiful, and yet be in an institution that she knows has such an anti-woman attitude? And this particular character knows it very well because she was a scholar of medieval church history. So that was always very clear to her. And also, what if women responded to violence in organized ways? And those two ways that I thought up, you know, in a fictional way, were, one would be separatism, just go away altogether. So there was that. And there was the other alternative was organizing in what you might call vigilante justice, you know, inflicting violence on men who are violent against women. So those were and that's what ends up happening in the fictional world of that novel. Both things. There's some separatism. There's an attempt at not women only, but a matrilineal and a matrifocal society that has a very different tone than a patriarchal society. And that's Erda. In the book, that's the former North Dakota. And then in what's left of the United States, that's where all the vigilante stuff is going on. And then, of course, in the United States, you have this one female Roman Catholic priest and all her ambivalence about that violence, about the violence of women against men, mm-hmm. because she can understand it. She understands why they're angry. And yet she also understands that Jesus was very unambiguous about turning the other cheek and forgiving and not answering violence mm-hmm. with violence.
Mm-hmm.
So she's in a very difficult situation. That tension is there throughout mm-hmm. the novel.
For the most part, and this can be like a trope that we just see in terms of religion in film or religion in media, is it's usually the worst of it, right? It's not, women are not usually involved unless they are victims. As you mentioned, and B, when it is mentioned, it's, well, we all know the Catholic Church and, you know, molestation of young boys, and it's a worthy topic, obviously, but I also wonder if that becomes the representation, that's the only way, and that kind of makes this kind of antagonistic viewpoint of religion, so that another generation is kind of like, no. You know? But giving Avril some agency, some feelings, and some sexuality, I think, also really was helpful to actually make her fully fleshed out being, because it could have been so easy to have a woman just be chaste and not want. And so I thought, and then also who you paired her up with. No spoilers, but.
although I think I give some of that away in the jacket copy. You know, you can read the back cover and you get some of that, because this is the female Roman Catholic priest, and she ends up starting to have visions, and she's very freaked out by that because she doesn't want them, and she also starts this obsessive affair with a really unsuitable man.
Yes.
And just how unsuitable, you know, readers will learn. But I think that it's kind of an open secret, I guess, among Catholics that priests have affairs.
Some people are. There's asexuality. Right. I don't want to dismiss that. But I also feel as though ignoring the fact that people do have those desires, even if they do pledge allegiance to an entity, is also kind of stereotypical.
Well, and there's a big debate within Catholicism, you know, because in other denominations and other religions, clergy are allowed to marry.
Yes.
But they aren't in Roman Catholicism.
Which is very odd to me. And again, that stems from my ignorance. Because again, being raised Southern Baptist AME churches.
The ministers.
They have wives, they have families. I mean, they're probably also having affairs. Let's not. I've heard some things.
Yeah,
but it's perfect. Not as in, oh, well, you're... Yeah, it's this pressure from... the Roman Catholic Church to do that.
Well, and there's two schools of thought about that. So there are people who are saying that, priests should be allowed to marry, and not just because they have sexual needs, not just because they're sexual beings, but also because they have emotional needs. You know, that there's a value in having a connection with another person, a spouse, having children if wanted, and that it doesn't make sense that the person could still be a good priest while having that full life, that those other emotional connections that they want, and that would be fine. You know, the world doesn't end, you know, just because the clergy is married. All the other religions have it, and it seems to work fine. They don't seem to be bad ministers because they have a spouse. So there's that contingent. And then the other side argues, though, that being a priest in the Roman Catholic Church is just something that requires your total devotion. It is an all-consuming mission and vocation, and that your attention can't be distracted or diluted with other things like a spouse and parenthood and so forth. And ironically, Avril is kind of in that second camp. So because she doesn't want to be married, she definitely doesn't want to be a parent, she loves being a priest. It seems to be like it's all she ever wanted to be. And so she's fine with normally with the celibacy.
Yeah.
It just didn't, she falls off the path in the course of the novel. But also, and again, this isn't really a spoiler, she ends up being in a friendship with somebody with a woman who is an assassin. One of the people one of the women who take what they think of as justice into their own hands. Avril becomes a dear friend of this woman. Avril feels this, she accepts the woman for even knowing what she does. And she even uses words to describe her like pure and beautiful and perfect. She uses those words when she thinks of Catherine. And I think it's just that Catherine is so unambivalent. She doesn't have any ambivalence about what she does. And maybe, you know, that's the total opposite of Avril, the main character, who is ambivalent about so much. So I think that's another relationship there that is unexpected, I guess.
Is that how you always envisioned Avril in the book?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember. how there's so many different elements and how they came to me, because so much of it was were not really conscious decisions. You know, these characters kind of, the characters and the story and the situation kind of just sort of bubbled up from my subconscious. I can trace what maybe motivated those subconscious things, you know, like my feelings about the church and so forth. But I don't recall consciously deciding, yes, I'm going to throw this kind of situation at her or that kind of situation. So I'm not sure I can answer that in a satisfying way. Did I always envision her as that? But probably, because I think I just sort of felt her various flaws, let's say, or the things that she felt conflicted about.
Getting into, I don't want to call it apocalyptic, but it is kind of apocalyptic. Yes. I keep saying, I don't want to call it that, but technically it is that. Because I always wonder if it's kind of going off the path of intention, but also in terms of interpretation, it very much is a world that we see on the page, at least. It becomes very fast, but we learn that this is happening over time. The disintegration of societies, the separation of genders, these kind of camps. So the use of things that we have seen in history being applied to try and create a better world. And that's when I think of this kind of, it's hard to call someone like Catherine a heroine, or even Avril a heroine, because is there a point when characters should say, that's enough, this is not okay? Because Avril does, she continues to treat everyone with humanity. She does not look at people as, you're my enemy, you're my friend, you're okay, you're not okay. She doesn't compartmentalize people the way that the guy does, and also Catherine does. And also people within, I guess, Catherine's army, because she's pretty hard ass. She's a hard ass. And I see how one builds those walls. So I also wonder, in terms of creating that apocalyptic state, did you kind of see or want to really reflect the difficulties of maintaining it, but also give some sympathy to other parties? Because I did feel sympathy for certain characters, and I won't name them because I don't want to give out spoilers, but when there's a point, and I'm going to use a lot of like, weird word. When you talk to your friend, you know that thing that happened that time when we were there, blah 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 blah. You're like, oh yeah, exactly, I got you. But there's that moment, I just felt so bad for that character and how they were treated. But it was understandable that this is the world now. This is the world now. And you kind of have to pay for your quote-unquote fathers, you know, like your ancestors, theoretical fathers or literal fathers' mistake. And I was just like, damn, but oh my gosh, but they didn't do anything. But then again, patriarchy.
And then again, trying to make sure that they don't do anything.
Yes, because the mindset still carries.
Right.
It still carries. So there's a danger in that mindset. So I felt very conflicted by the end of not who I should root for, but whether, okay, is this the best thing for society? And maybe, again, maybe you didn't know. Maybe it was unconscious. Maybe it's just how everything unfolded when you got to the page. But I was just kind of curious about exploring this idea of, even in these kind of societies that are meant to take something away, that they actually keep it in the family, so to speak. Like, it's cyclical, that even if you enslave or imprison or separate or segregate, so to speak, that these things never really truly fade unless we face it. And I mean, truly face it. And I don't know that Catherine does.
No. And she's very, I think she's very clear about that. She accepts herself, and she accepts her choices and her decisions to rely on violence all the time, for any problem. So she's an interesting antithesis to April. But I'm glad that you felt, I didn't want to just answer the questions. I wanted to raise the questions. So I'm glad that you felt some sympathy and some ambivalence about, wait, what's right and what's wrong here? Because I don't think those are simple questions. And these different characters answer it different ways. It might seem like some of them pay too high a price for advocating for advocating justice or nonviolence or whatever, not to give spoilers. But then that's something left for the reader to think about.
Yeah. Well, it made me also think about books like The Hunger Games, right? Where we start off and we see how horrible and, you know, trudging this world is. And it doesn't, but it kind of, it doesn't do the tie up with a bow, but it kind of presumes. It presumes that everything is way better now than it was before, because we just got the right leader in there and we rebelled and we got rid of the bad guys and it's fine. Like, everything's fine because we got rid of the bad guys. And I wondered, after reading Kingdom of Women, is that a narrative? I love The Hunger Games, don't get me wrong, but are those fair narratives to have those kind of, we have a dystopia and then we built a utopia just based on this, but not showing that, like you said, they're more questions than answers. You really can't just say, okay, and then we have Catherine in charge and she's perfect and everything got fixed and patriarchy is gone and we're good.
Right, and there isn't a clear solution, because there are people paying the price at the end that we're not sure that really should be paying that price.
And the repercussions of that, the upheavals of as we've seen with this previous presidential election, of thought we were good, and then just like boom.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's always that potential. Good book.
Thank you.
I remember talking to Nick Stone about it, is that she said as well, she said, I didn't necessarily want to answer questions. I just wanted to show that it was good to understand that they're not always answers. And that's what that seems to be the culmination of our conversation also, is because I think, and I ask you this as someone who was raised so much in religion, is there kind of this prevalent notion that there are answers, that God has all answers? That's how I've perceived it when I've been to church, is don't worry about it, God has all the answers. And I said, but really though?
That's a very problematic aspect of religion. And for what it's worth, I would say that there are traditions within all the religions, especially the mainstream religions, there are mystical traditions within them, mystical strains, where people are okay with saying, you know what, maybe God doesn't know, or maybe we have no way of knowing what God wants, and we just have to keep going, we have to keep plugging along no matter what, and all we can do is live with that mystery and try to apply the golden rule to each other. And the golden rule, or it has other names too, but it's called the golden rule in Christianity, is to treat others like you want to be treated. So there is that strain within all these religions that also have people saying it's the will of God and this is what God wants and God knows what's going on and it's all part of his plan and so forth. There, within those same religions, there are also strains of people who are saying, you know what, that it's all a mystery. And we don't know. And I think, to give Catholicism credit, it makes a lot of room for mysticism in a way that perhaps Protestantism doesn't much at all. And so there's there might be less talk in Catholicism of this is God's will or this is part of God's plan. Mm-hmm. Because Catholicism allows for so much more weirdness and mystery.
Yeah.
So, you know, because the thing is, yeah, as a novelist, you don't want to answer the questions and tie everything up too neatly. But when you think about the characters in the world you've created, they still have to muddle through. They have to act.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they do have to make decisions about what's the right way to act and what isn't. And mm-hmm. so they make certain ones, but we as the readers can argue with each other over whether they were right. Mm-hmm. But we have the luxury of sitting back and just reading about that instead of having those choices thrust on us. Mm-hmm. Because we're not in a dystopia at this point, anyway.
Knock on wood. I will do that because I'm next to wood.
It's true. I'm next to a couch.
Well, thank you so much, Rosalie, for being on, and congrats on Kingdom of Women. Such a vibrant book that I hope finds itself in the right hands for the right people and encourages so much discussion. I think this is book club worthy. This is a book club worthy book. It might make some people uncomfortable, but what ifs?
that's what I'm really curious to see. So I'm really eager to find out how other readers and other reviewers are responding to this. So hopefully in the next few weeks, I'll get more of a sense of that.
Yeah, I hope so too. Because there's so much more to be said about this book. And I'd be interested in hearing what people who identify as very, you know, non-binary, male, female, people of various colors, people who are religious, people who aren't religious, kind of take to it. Because I feel like it's not laden with message. And I think that's what we need more of with religious books, or books that look at, it's not like overdose of message, but just experience things through the characters and see what goes on, what happens, see where it goes. Some people get their comeuppance, some people don't. Just saying.
It's like life.
So how may people reach out to you and learn more about you as writer, as well as you as publisher?
Well, they can go to the website of my press, which is www.shademountainpress.com. Mm-hmm. So Shade, S-H-A-D-E, Mountain spelled out, Shade Mountain Press. That's the name of the press. And then I do have a WordPress site for myself as an individual. So if they just Google my name, Rosalie Morales Kearns, I think that site is the first thing that comes up.
Okay.
So they'll get a lot of information about the other things I've published and links to them when they're available online. Mm-hmm.
And also, you're on the social media as well.
Yes, indeed. I'm on Twitter, R. Morales Kearns. And again, if you search for my name, you would find that. And Shade Mountain, the Twitter handle is a little shortened. It's Shade MTPR. Mm-hmm. Again, not that hard to find, but yeah, we're on Twitter, and the
Facebook.
Press has a Facebook. Yeah. Yep, press has a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. And so, you can find all the books, previous and upcoming. And your book is on Kingdom of Women, again, December 1st. That's available Amazon, all places books are sold.
Yes, indeed.
And ebook too? So it's print and ebook?
Yes. Kindle. I'm not sure about other forms of ebook. Mm-hmm. The publisher, Jaded Ibis, they distribute through Ingram.
Ah.
And I'm not sure. I know there is a Kindle and a paperback on Amazon, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the paperback is at Barnes and Noble. But I don't remember whether there was a Nook. I think there is.
Awesome! I'm glad it's in stores. Yes. So again, this December 1st, Kingdom of Women. And thanks for listening to the podcast. Again, you can find it at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com on Tumblr at Minorities in Pub on Twitter, as well as on TuneIn, iTunes, and Google Play, where you can listen to, subscribe, and rate the podcast. Thanks so much, and talk to you next episode.